And in Sunday school, I would ask questions that they would tell me I had no right to ask, and just to shut up, essentially. But there was also the sense of, what does it mean to live a Christian life? I come from a family, my mother's side of the family, her father was from the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, Mayu. And how can we elevate so that we become compassionate from a supra global perspective? How do we turn that technology into a blanket of compassion as opposed to what we're doing, what we're creating?
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. I am the producer, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, the guest we have. Hello, Bud. Welcome, Bud, to our podcast. We are into our mid-60s. Actually, I'm in my early 70s. Clay is in his early 60s, but the podcast in his mid-60s. But the podcast is in its mid-60s as far as where we're going, and we finally have intersected with you, so welcome.
Thank you. The podcast is accelerating faster than we are, though, isn't it? It will get to 100 before we do.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
Both of us have come into our lives through I came in through as a child through Christian Science and went into metaphysics and all that. And Clay, you came into the New Thought movement through Unity, correct?
That's right. Yeah. As a child, I grew up Catholic, and then I spent time in the Missouri Synod Lutheran tradition and hiatus, like many guys do. And then I set foot in the Unity Church and felt like the prodigal son had come home.
Wow. What was your story, Bud? What was some of your journey?
Institutionally, Martinsburg, West Virginia, the northern end of the Shenandoah Valley, Bible Belt, fundamentalist church, revivals, prayer meetings, worship Sunday morning, Sunday night, youth groups. The church was my life for many, many years.
Did you have the experience? I'm going to interrupt you in this because things that I had is that I would sit in the back of the church whenever I would go to some meetings, and I would see people get into paroxysms of joy and connection, being saved, having that. And I kept wondering, what's wrong with me? Did you have those experiences? Were you able to connect that way?
Oh, I had ambivalence, not that experience. Langston Hughes writes about that in his Laughing to Keep from Crying. I don't know if you've ever read that, but it's an amazing personal story about exactly what you described. No, I had resentment toward that faith because, well, my friends were outside playing baseball. I was sitting on cold, hard metal chairs in the church basement at prayer meetings. On the other hand, in prayer meetings, we would have these long silences while it was called a season of prayer, and people were encouraged to pray. But if they didn't, there would just be silence, and you just pray for the minister to end it, but it didn't end. And yet in those silences, I think when I look back on those meetings, that's what I remember. There was a beauty to those as well.
Did you have a connection with the words, with the message? In one of the videos that I've seen of you, you were talking about how if we practiced the message that is in the Gospels, if we did that and walked the walk like one of our teachers, Jesus, did, that we would be a much... We would live much differently. But so did that resonate with you at all?
Yes. There was both an intellectual component and a practical component. And the intellectual was so stifling, you know, that I wanted to scream sometimes. And in Sunday school, I would ask questions that they would tell me I had no right to ask, and just to shut up, essentially. But there was also the sense of, what does it mean to live a Christian life? And that had to do with, I come from a family, my to tell you a little bit about the family, because it's important. My mother's side of the family, two pieces there. Her father was from the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, Mayu of Fredericksburg, Virginia. Sure. Klan weddings, Klan banking, Klan all sorts of things. I mean, it was a big deal.
These would be in the 20s and 30s.
Oh, right? That was right. But he never, it never left him. I mean, he, when he died, we had Klan paraphernalia to get rid of, essentially. His wife had brittle bone disease. Her family, osteogenesis imperfecta. My mother had it. My aunts had it, my cousin, I, so there was a built-in fragility, vulnerability, not in this, in an emotional sense, but in a physical sense, even disability in throughout the family. And I think therefore, and then we saw the way my grandfather treated my grandmother and that made us more compassionate. I mean, to speak of the word here, I mean, from the very beginning, of course, my grandmother is to this day a saint in my pantheon. We used to, she used to give us rides on her wheelchair and you know, things like that. We got to eat the first fruitcakes at Christmas time and all of that. So that was the milieu of the family. And then my father, his dad died when he was 14. Mm-hmm. And he went off, he was in the 1930s, his father was a construction worker. He had really bad congestive heart failure, but he had to work. And they lived in a tent. There were 11 surviving children, and they moved around following construction. And basically the men would come and pick him up, take him to work, put him in a steam shovel, and then carry him home, and then he would sort of sleep until the next day. He died when my dad was 14, so dad left home then at 14 and went off to the CCC camps, and from there to the war, and then he came back. So he didn't have any church background at all. Mother had Baptist, good, solid Baptist, Klan Baptist. religion, and that was it. They took the family to a revival one time on the outskirts of town. It was a tent meeting, and when we had tent meetings, I mean, everybody would show up, and you know, you had sawdust on the ground, and you had the folding chairs in the tent and the lights, and Eddie Martin was the evangelist. He wore bright red blazer. He had flowing hair, red hair, and he paced across the stage with a Bible in his hand, and he yelled and whatever. But my family was converted at that. And my dad came home, and he took all the beer out of the refrigerator, and he poured it down the sink. I mean, he never was a heavy drinker anyway, but he did that. And from that moment on, we had religion. we really did. I mean, we really did. Dad was became a firefighter. He drove a bread truck. He drove a milk truck. He was a firefighter. And on his, when he was at the fire hall, he would read the Bible. And he really, really read. And he only had a 10th grade education, but he had an inquiring mind. And so he was always questioning and asking and questioning and asking. And so to the day he died, he was a fundamentalist. But to the day he died, he was open-minded. You know, that's a really nice combination.
Wow, frankly. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So he would, I remember when two candidates were running for sheriff in Martinsburg, he had both of their stickers on his car. And people said, "You can't do that, Jim." His name is Jim. And he said, "Well, why not?" He said, "They're both good people. And I like them both. Why can't I support them both?" I get that myself. I mean, do you get that? It seems to me there's nothing wrong with that. That's good thinking. You don't have to be one against the other.
Isn't that right? We can hold more than one thought in our heads.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He said, "I have to vote for one of them, but you know, either one will do fine." So he was my scoutmaster. He was the best man at my wedding. He was really important to me in lots of ways. For him, the essence of what you ask about the faith was living it out. It was we would paint somebody's house because they couldn't do it for themselves. We would clean their yards. He would give them rides to the doctor. He would do on his days off. He was constantly doing things for other people, and that's what he had me doing too. So yes, that was the practice. So there was a practice that made sense, and there was a theology that made no sense at all.
And so if we were to skip, not just fast forward to today, mm-hmm. and the sense of where we are as both as what Clay and I are doing in what we know what we're doing anyway, of the sense that in search of, because that's what we're making it as an in search, we're seeing, well, where is it that we are able to, and each, because we have interviewed people from Islam and from who are very secular and non-secular and the entire basis of it. So what do you see in today's world? How do you see us coming back together in your experience? And because you're a Unitarian minister now, right?
I'm working in a Unitarian church. I'm United Church of Christ.
Yes.
But I think had I found the Unitarian church earlier, I might actually be a Unitarian. Mm-hmm. You know, none of these are vessels, and none of them are big enough. None of them are big enough there. You do what you can, you know, with what's out there. This week, I don't know when this will be run, but this week the Japanese just dropped off a little package in the atmosphere of some dirt that they brought back from a asteroid, and it took them 6 years to get there and to scoop it up and to bring it back, and they're going to send this little explorer on into the space again, and it goes hundreds of millions of miles, and the kind of precision and all of that, and we're looking at Mars, and the Chinese are looking at the base on the moon, and there's all this going on, and I cannot for the life of me imagine how religion can remain untouched by all of this interstellar exploration. Are we going to be Muslims and Christians and Jews when we get to Mars? It doesn't make sense to me. Just like, no, there's new consciousness coming all the time, and we need to break down on these barriers we have to letting it in and see what happens. Christianity, there was a time when it wasn't, and then there was a time when it came into being, and it may be a time for it to yield to a new consciousness that's coming.
Yes.
Certainly, it's been corrupted. The religions have been corrupted a lot that what we have now, and it carries a lot of baggage, and the baggage isn't necessarily good. Some is wonderful, some is good, but so we don't know, do we, what it's going to look like? We don't know.
One of the things that struck me in 2008, I saw Karen Armstrong's TED Talk, and that was the spark that started Charter for Compassion. And I collaborate with Charter for Compassion quite a bit, and I'm actually working to help develop the men's initiative, if you will, for the charter. And it's really struck me when she said that, all the major religious traditions in the world have the golden rule in common, and they say it all differently, but it's in the essence of that is the golden rule. And compassion is how that's played out. And I was not going to church at the time. I was in between, then, but I had just come out of a pretty severe health crisis. And she said that, and it really stuck with me. So while everything is maybe splintering, or the different traditions are, doing what they have, they still have that one thing in common.
The Dalai Lama says, "My religion is compassion."
Ah,
there you have it. I think I've worked with him a little bit, and I was at a an event in San Francisco, and he said he had a Muslim. This was an event he did especially for Muslims, and but I was invited to be part of it. And he said, you believe in a creation. You believe in a creator God. And he said, and that makes you a better person. And I don't believe in a creator, and I don't believe in a creator God, and that makes me a better person. So what's wrong with that?
Yeah. I love the idea of one of the things that we had in nursery school. I mean, in Sunday school when I was a kid, in the Christian Science Church, is that they would say a phrase that there's not a spot where God is not. And so it was a way of getting omniscience. All right, wait a minute. If it's everywhere, if it is all God or all good, everything, if there isn't anything, there isn't inside, outside, there's no way to put a circle around it, because it is, it's all there is, then it gives me an opportunity then to say, okay, well, what is it that I believe inside of me that is not? And how do I address that piece?
Well, I'm troubled by that identification of God with everything, because of the enormous amount of apparent suffering,
yes,
in the world, and evil, possibly. At least what appears to me, to my limited perspective, as evil in the world, lack of compassion, if you will.
Yep.
I don't have an answer. I mean, I'm not a metaphysician. I'm not a theologian. And the older I get, the less interested I am in the great philosophies of life.
Wonderful. But,
yeah. So I remember Solzhenitsyn wrote that the line separating good and evil runs through every human heart, mm-hmm, and all hearts, and it oscillates over time. So sometimes there's more good in us, and sometimes there's less good in us, but it's always there. And I suspect that's true. I can't speak for you, but in me, there isn't all, it's not all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love how you say that. When I was growing up, there was the old timers that we'd sit around and listen to the stories. They'd always start out with the story is, they'd always start out their stories with, well, I don't know about you. And then they'd start the story. And they'd say, well, I don't know about you. And it wasn't until that I was realized how wise that is, because I don't know about you. And I need to open up my ears. When Clay and I were doing part of the series on this, a dear friend of Clay's, and who has become John, this was right after the George Floyd, right?
Yes, after May 25th, when George Floyd was murdered.
Yeah.
Yes, John Fleming.
John Fleming, and he's an African American man, and he was talking about how people would come up to him and ask him, mm-hmm, "Well, what should I do? What should I? How should I?" And his answer was, "Study me. Study my life, because I have spent my life studying you.
Absolutely.
I have spent my whole life studying how to succeed in your world. Do your homework. Study my life." Study what it's like to be me, the challenges there are, and then come to me.
What a powerful evening that was. John happens to be my prayer chaplain, and we've known each other for quite a while. And when we realized, it was actually on a Monday night, May 25th, Monday night, when we have our men's circle. And, we had no idea what was going on out there. We had no idea about George Floyd until the next morning. And it just, a shockwave, you know, went through me. And as the day went on, I started to realize that, my gosh, that night, we've got a pretty good mix of men, but that night we were 20 white guys sitting in a circle, and our topic of conversation was aspirations. What are your aspirations? And the next day I thought, oh my God, while we were talking about our aspirations, George Floyd was being murdered. I wonder what his aspirations were. And that really had an impact. And the first person I thought to call was John.
Bud, did you have models of men when you were growing up and models that you could, I mean, I know you had your father and what you, but both Clay and I grew up distrusting men because for many reasons. And that was your relationship with men and your relationship with the men of the community and what you saw of yourself aligned?
Well, there were a lot of men. I had a stable community. So the people that I knew, and I lived in that community for 18, 19 years. So I knew them over a lifetime, over that part of my life. And some were dangerous. You know, my grandfather was dangerous. Had an uncle who was an alcoholic and abusive to his wife over and over and over, who was my aunt, who I loved. So there were dangerous men, and, you know, I learned, you learn about that. You learn about that. At the same time, they're family, and so you don't reject them. In the way we were brought up, you know, yep. You love them, but be clear, you know, what is it, trust but verify? Something like that. But there were, there was a minister who was the minister of my life for so many years. He's buried next to my mother. They actually did have a special friendship anyway, so that's kind of nice that they are. Mm-hmm. And he was very encouraging and very nurturing, but he didn't allow for intellectual inquiry. So in sort of that area of that was most important to me was, you know, to ask penetrating questions and see where we go. I remember you are old enough probably to remember John Robinson's Honest to God, little paperback, little book that Bishop Robinson wrote. And it upset a lot of people because he encouraged people to ask questions. And he himself asked questions. And I brought it into my minister and said, what do I make of this? It was really a disturbing book for me. I was in high school at the time, maybe freshman, very young. And he took the book from me and he threw it across the room. And he said, Robinson doesn't have a leg to stand on. And I said, well, can you explain that? And he said, I just read the first few pages and I threw it down. I don't need, you know, I respected this man. He nurtured my career and my spirituality and encouraged that in every way. But still, you know, that's pretty serious to me. That was like, here's a young guy asking a question and you dismiss it. It's like,
yeah.
So I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but there were teachers, high school teachers, some more nurturing, I guess, than others.
Yeah.
But I didn't. Did you use the word fear, men?
Or trust.
Trust, ahead, I think. Because I grew up not trusting men. And
that wasn't an issue for me.
Yeah, yeah. And in my growth, I got to this place where I realized that there was some things that I could only learn from another man, a conversation that I could only have with another man, but I was taught not to trust men. My experience taught me that. And so I thought, I've got to bridge this gap somehow. And long story short, that's how I started our men's circle in 2012. And it was just the need to come together in a non-threatening environment, in a safe environment, no judgment, nobody's going to try and fix anybody. It's a contemplative circle where we can learn how to speak from here, because that vocabulary got shut off, you know, speaking from the heart. Like, we didn't learn how to do that. And so I find myself practicing that and hearing other men, and we all learn together in that respect. And I've gotten over that fear in the process.
And for us, Bud, to be able to speak, for it to be a safe place for 18-year-old Bud to come into and ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
With other men and other.
One thing, every once in a while we'll have a young fella, because we tend to be, you know, 40s and on up. Every once in a while we'll have a young fella, 18 or 19 or 20, come in, and typically they're real quiet. 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And this one fella came in one night after 3 or 4 weeks coming. And when he started opening his mouth, I swear he was channeling the wisdom that came from his lips. And of course, the whole circle, there were 20, 25 of us in the circle, we just stopped. And that would happen more times than not. And I thought, oh my gosh, where are these younger folks learning this? You know, his path growing up was not necessarily religious, but he had really gone through some hardships, really had some hardships growing up. And I think that that there was wisdom gained there. And he certainly was a gift to us while he was coming.
Did you interview him on the show?
I've got to find him.
Oh,
I've got to find
do
him.
Do that.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Bud, what questions are going through your mind now? What kinds of things are you addressing and are spending your energy in at this time in your life?
Oh, well, we're at COVID. I'm in Florida. I've been in the house since March, so I'm mm-hmm. climbing the walls right now. I don't know. I look back and I wonder if the decisions that I made were the so-called right decisions. I'm discovering now, I'm 75 almost, and I'm discovering now how deeply satisfying writing is for me.
Mm.
And I always knew I was a writer, but I never believed it. I mean, if people would tell me, you know, from the time I was in high school, but I never accepted that really. And now I'm feeling like I have so much to write, but I lack discipline. I may need you as a coach here, sir. I may need to call you back and say, okay.
We'll work on that.
Yeah, how do I make myself sit down and do it? I've got a book that I'm working on, but it's a really ambitious undertaking.
Well, let me ask you, is that your third book?
Yeah, it would be a real book. Collections of essays.
What are you, Pinocchio? You know, someday you're going to be a real boy? Now, come on, Bud.
Well, now, I've got to mention.
Collections of essays that I put together as a fundraiser for a school.
Well, I see one of them is A Faith in a Minor Key.
Faith in a Minor Key.
Faith in a Minor Key. And the other one is
When Easter Interrupts.
When Easter Interrupts.
Right.
Great.
Those are collections of essays that I did over a lifetime. So from the secular press and from church newsletters and excerpts from sermons and things like that. They're not bad, you know, some of them. But what I want to do now is a book on Jesus as perceived through the eyes of the world's religions. And that is because I want to see Jesus, frankly. The more you know, the less you know. That's what mm-hmm. I'm finding. And so I'm just fascinated by how he has captured the imagination of people in every tradition,
yes,
both positively and negatively. I mean, there's also a rejectionist view. So I want to work on that. And I'm aware that at my age, And I'm also having some visual problems. So actually, you know, seeing is hard. So I'm beginning to think now, I mean, this, what is it? The irony of American history. This is the irony of Bud's history. It's like, now I'm ready to write and now I can't see. So the questions is like, why, you know, why? And will I get another chance? You know,
well, boy, that is so true.
Yeah. Isn't that beautiful?
Or is this it? You know, is this it? Will this be it? And will COVID do it? You know, will I be talking to anyone by, you know, this time next year? Mm-hmm. I feel very, you used the word vulnerable. I mean, I really feel that in spades right now. I have also some cardiac issues and some lung issues and some other things. So,
it's an amazing it's an amazing experience, because I think about that with the both the interpretations of Jesus and that, and I have this sense of I would really like to know those years between like 18 and 30. Mm-hmm. There's the and for, you know, I hear of that there are tales in the East of his travels, you know, different places that he might have been in India or any of that experience. But that just fascinates me.
Yeah, I'd like to go on a pilgrimage over the Silk Road. That would be in my bucket list if I could do that. You know, I don't know if I have the physical stamina to do it right now. I need a good guide too.
Yeah.
But there's the Jesus Sutras from China. You should see them if you haven't. They were probably put together in the 7th century, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it's very Buddhist in its feeling. And it's like, okay. And that I'm going to be exploring that whole Silk Road question.
Yeah.
My point will not be, I don't know if this is even relevant to what we're talking about here tonight. My point will be simply that it doesn't matter. I mean, we don't know. We never will know. What matters is that the story of Jesus grows out of a world that was not centered around the Mediterranean, but was far more cosmopolitan. It was more the Silk Road all the way to China, all the way to Spain. I mean, all Africa. All of that was part of that milieu out of which he rose. And he was Jewish, but from that, anyway, never mind. We don't need to go into all of that, but that's...
Oh, that's fascinating.
Are you kidding? That's so fascinating. That is deeply compelling. I'm so glad you're exploring that.
Well, I'm trying to, but I have trouble reading also. So it's a problem. Now, all the books... back there, you know, those are Jesus books.
Yeah.
Jesus in Muslim, Islam, Jesus in Judaism, Jesus in Native American theology. It's all there.
We have a sense of Jesus, and have a sense, each one of us has, you know, through whatever stories that we have, but there is, it feels like it's much more nuanced and interesting than is just portrayed in the marketing of Jesus and in the marketing. I think it,
the marketing that could be the title of my book, The Marketing of Jesus. So you're right. I have an Anishinaabe friend in Illinois. He always says the story I'm about to tell you may not have happened quite the way I tell you, but it's a true story nonetheless.
Exactly. And
that's as good as it gets. Oh. Yeah, it's in these days of Trump, it's a little dicey to stray from the literal truth. But, you know, we have to go to the realm of meaning.
And exactly.
The realm of meaning is not necessarily, you know, my dad taught me that. He was a literalist, but it didn't matter. Buddy, he'd say, now the Bible's right. You know, the Bible's true, but he'd say, if I wrote down, I'm in a pickle. So you'd know what I mean, and your mom would know what I mean, but somebody reading it 1,000 years from now would say, how is he in a pickle? You know, how did that? I mean, you know, you get it. It's something silly, but yeah.
But it isn't. This is what I love about, because Shakespeare, people will sit down and talk about how Shakespeare is this wonderful, high-minded, and while everything that he has, he wrote for the people. He has so many pop culture references that were absolutely hilarious that we have no idea what they are.
We are sure in West Virginia that you know, Elizabethan music and Elizabethan accent came over with the Scotch-Irish and settled in the hollers of West Virginia. So they say, if you want to hear Shakespeare in the original accented English, you have to go to the hollers of West Virginia.
Oh, my.
So it's to be or not to be, that is the question. There's a noble mind to suffer. You know, that's.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But, you know, oh, well. My wife, by the way, would be embarrassed by what I just did. For me, one of the key points of being alive is wonder or awe or beauty. And Facebook, for example, allows you to share an enormous amount of natural beauty,
yes,
of animal beauty. I mean, there's so much wonderful in the world, in our world, and that can all, and there are, and there's a hunger for that. People want it and they look for it,
yes,
and they see it. So that's a gift. I mean, I've had those incredible moments from the time I was a child, you know, going up the Massanutten in the Shenandoah Valley and looking out over the valley and just being overwhelmed and completely one with, even though I was a fundamentalist and not a Buddhist, it didn't matter. Yeah. You know, it just captured me. Music can do this to me. I can tell you of instances when I've sat in concerts and couldn't move after when the piece was ended. You know, everybody's applauding and standing and I'm just sitting there, sometimes in tears, sometimes not, because something bigger than me has flowed through me or infused me, or I'm part of it and whatever. It's just wonder. And so,
You know, it makes me feel like that they've hijacked the word awful.
Yeah.
Because why would that not be a beautiful word? I'm full of awe.
Exactly.
Has that experience and the experience of that giving you any peace with your own death, with your own sense of whatever this is that we all get a chance to go through?
Depends on what day you talk to me about it. There is hunger. Howard Thurman, right? Deep is the hunger, you know, to know. I just want to know more than I'm allowed to know at this point. I think the Tibetans probably have it right in terms of what is next. I think they're the scientists of death in a way that the rest of us haven't even begun to understand. Sometimes I want it. Sometimes I'm just tired. I'm just finished. I'm just over it. And I want it. I want to go. And other times it's like, no, not yet. You know, maybe, you know, come back another day. So I don't know that the peace is what I would describe. I'm okay with living, and I guess I'm okay with dying when it comes. The I don't know goes to the goodness of God as well. I mean, on the one hand, professional in religion, we say, don't worry, God is good, it'll all be all right, everything will be okay in the end, you know. And actually, you know, but what if that's not true? You know, and how am I supposed to know these things? You know, this is the issue. So I'll just leave that. I would just want to say, my work with diversity, I just need to say that, is another place where we can be vulnerable and expand our understanding of the world and our place in it and the mysteries that it involves. I remember in high school, we integrated the high school in the 1960s, right after Brown versus Board in 57. And there was an African, very, very nice African-American man, young man, and I were in a gym class together. And we, even though we integrated, we didn't talk to each other. It didn't happen. We kept apart. Yep. And we were sitting together, and I decided to try to have a conversation. This was in the shower room, and I said, "So what are you going to do when you graduate?" And he said, "I'm going to Howard University." And I remember feeling terribly embarrassed because I had no idea what Howard University was or where it was. Or it was just down Washington, D.C., not that far from us. And it's one of the great African-American universities. And I was embarrassed because I didn't know what school he's going to. And then he was embarrassed because I was embarrassed. I don't know if you understand, but I realized that just the question made for an awkward conversation. And it was only years later that I actually did my doctorate at Howard University, where I really did learn how important that school is. But if we don't take the risk, I'm trying to think of the Catholic theologian, Thomas Merton, said, we won't overcome the differences in the world unless we take them into ourselves and live them out, which has been, I just believe that, absolutely do believe that. And yet it's impossible to do. But if we can put ourselves in situations where we are not in control and where we don't, our interpretations don't control, and we open ourselves to whatever happens in that situation, I mean, that can have a downside depending on, you know, what you're talking about. But that's where it's at. That's where you really begin to grow, change, whatever. So
that idea of the kind of conversation, Bud, that you're talking about is our highest aspiration for In Search Of, to have conversations that we have no idea what they are, that we are here as learners, and we want to grow. We want to grow past our discomforts. We want to grow out through our ignorance and celebrate the fact that I am ignorant and I have this wonderful opportunity to be able to sit down with you and grow and learn, and Clay, that I do each time that I'm around you, and to have that kind of vulnerability, to have my way of thinking populated with a diversity of thought, have that field that I have. Because I mean, I look out at a field, and if there is a monoculture in a field, that field is going to be depleted. But if you have a rich and diverse horticultural and animal population in there, that field is going to thrive. And my mind is the same way. My consciousness is the same way.
I have guilt about where we live. You know, just that we're in a suburb of Sarasota. And so for our condo to be built, that field had to be leveled. And the animals that lived here, they're gone. And I saw some of them early on. We've been here now 3 years, but I don't see them anymore. And there were birds, and we don't hear the birds now. We still hear the frogs. We will have snakes. There are alligators that knock at the door occasionally. But the way we're living with the planet right now, here I am. I mean, I'm benefiting from a lifestyle that is hostile to the planet. I mean, I don't like it. I feel as if, I'd like to do it some other way. the cutting edge, I guess, something to work on.
As we're working on. Well, thank you, Bud, for joining us today. Clay, Thank you, dear one, for having me along on this wonderful podcast and the opportunity to meet you, bud. Thank you for the deep questioning that you're doing on a day by day, moment by moment basis is an inspiration for me.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a delightful conversation, very meaningful conversation. I appreciate it a lot. Thank you very, very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you. And we will see all of you, everyone who watched, everyone who listened, and we'll see you next time in search of the new compassionate male.
And here's the conversation after the interview.
My question, I think the challenge for you is to how to raise the question of compassion to supramundial, above the earth. This world that we're going to be creating quickly of, as I say, a base on the moon, the explorations that we're doing with Mars, this is going to happen overnight. I mean, this is just happening. What is also happening is that we're militarizing that whole space. We're going to be creating electromagnetic weapons to put out computers, and I mean, it's horrible. And how can we elevate so that we become compassionate from a supra global perspective? How do we turn that technology into a blanket of compassion as opposed to what we're doing, what we're creating? Because we're just repeating what. And I don't know, you know, I think I had a dream the other night and there were these Neanderthals, you know, from around the fire, and they got up and they took their primitive weapons and they went off and attacked another group of Neanderthals. And then it morphed into, I don't know, first century, whatever. Then it morphed into medieval and just battle after battle after battle with more weapons becoming more sophisticated and more destructive to where we are today. How can we stop that?
Yeah.
You know, that's how do we stop that acceleration of destructive technology?
Well, and so many people from different frames of reference are saying that this is a point in human history. We've come to a place of change. You know, I call it the liminal space. You know, it's this just about to take off. And of course, with that comes a lot of fear, but with also comes the opportunity to do what you're talking about, to let's do it right. And I liken it to, you know, Copernicus, you know, back in 1543, wrote the paper and put it out and said, well, folks, you got it wrong. The sun doesn't rotate around the earth. It's the other way around. And if you look at the magnitude of that, the whole world had to do a reset because everything that was based on that scientific fact that the sun rotated around the earth was wrong. And so this massive, a new genesis, Richard Tarnas writes about it in his book Cosmos and Psyche, but this new genesis of change, fundamental change, and the thought is that we're at that place right now again, which is tremendously exciting, and it's also scary. I love the question: how do we take it on the macro scale?
I think you're doing one wonderful piece by building a global
constellation. That's what I,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I think I felt like at the beginning of COVID, we had that chance. I mean, at the beginning of COVID, we understood that we were all in the same stew.
Mm-hmm.
And Italians were singing to each other and the air was cleaner in India and everything was, I mean, the possibility was we could see it. We could actually see it. Jose Ortega y Gasset used to speak about humanity. The human is a metaphysical centaur. He said, we're half animal and half something else. And maybe this is it. Maybe this.
Yeah,
I think for him it was aspiration. I was in an Atlanta church, and they weren't. Some of the leadership wasn't too happy about the interfaith work I was doing. Some were really excited, and I got invited to do the kind of warm up act for the Dalai Lama in San Francisco. You're doing great work, and you could probably get the Dalai Lama, I think, if he isn't too old and too.
When you said that you had done some work with him, my ears perked up.